Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever or whenever you are. This is the Lightning Podcast, where we discuss and explore the weekly meditations without necessarily reaching any conclusions. Welcome. I'm your host, Cyrus Polizban, and I'm joined today by Zohar Atkins, Genevieve Kim, Nicolas Sarian, and Anne Dudek. Welcome, everybody. The quote we are covering today is by Ennius, and it reads, "He who does not know how to use leisure has more of work than when there is work and work." Zohar, how do you interpret this quote? I'll start with you.
So I have two interpretations. The first is the more obvious one, which is when you're not working, you better not be working. Don't fake not working, because then you'll never rejuvenate. And so it will worsen your leisure and it will worsen your work. Like, the purpose of a vacation is to not think about work, not to like check your email. I'm guilty of that for sure. I think the more interesting interpretation, though, of the less obvious one, is inspired by the analysis of Hannah Arendt. So let's just take a moment to actually think about the word leisure, which in Greek was skole. Leisure is not the same as time off. I'm going to be a little bit elitist for a second and say that most of the things that people do in their time off or spare time would not qualify as leisure from an ancient Greek or philosophical point of view. Watching 6 hours of Netflix probably doesn't qualify as leisure, even if you really enjoy it. Going to the gym and keeping your body in shape or whatever it is, going to CrossFit, that may not be leisure in the Greek sense of the word. So we should, I think the discussion that I want to take us down is, what is the difference between time off and leisure? And what if leisure requires a certain proactivity or a certain work in its own regard, a different kind of work? So what then is leisure? And so that here is where we would think about Aristotle, who said that in order to philosophize, you need leisure. And this was one practical reason why slaves couldn't do philosophy, not because they didn't have the capacity, but because situationally, they didn't enjoy enough leisure to, for example, think about questions that don't have a bottom line, that don't have a practical agenda item attached to them. So how do you get out of that mindset? What's the ROI on this question? If you can just delight in ideas for their own sake, then I think you're closer to leisure. But even when you're doing philosophy, or you're doing history, or you're doing literature, whatever it is you're doing, but you're thinking about it through the lens of, if you will, business or efficiency or productivity, you're not in leisure. What do others think?
That sounds like a creative brainstorming. But you set up the rule that you're not going to make any rules or any wrong answers or any questions. So you just
I'm gonna set up a dichotomy and then we can play with it. So I think we should define work not in terms of something that you get paid for, but rather something that you do in order to achieve a goal. And I think we should define leisure as something that you do for its own sake. If you're doing Pilates because you simply enjoy doing Pilates for its own sake, perhaps that's leisure. If you're doing Pilates because you want to show off your abs when you go to the beach, so that's work. And so when you're reading Plato for graduate school because you have to pass an exam, that's actually not leisure, that's work. So I think Ennius is drawing our attention to the fact that a lot of things that we think are leisure are actually not leisurely. And this point is amplified by Arendt, who would say we've actually lost the art of leisure. You would have thought that the Industrial Revolution freed up our time so that more people could enjoy leisure. That's a democratizing element of modernity and capitalism, is look, it's no longer just kings and princes and ladies and noblemen that get to think about the finer things in life and have 8-hour dinners or dinner parties. Like, now your typical middle-class person can do it as well. And Arendt would say, yeah, but the irony is, and again, this sounds super elitist, instead of what's happening isn't that the middle class are now enjoying leisure, it's that even the rich are acting like slaves. Nobody actually is a true aristocrat anymore, because even your typical Fortune 500 CEO is checking his phone at dinner or reading the books that Bill Gates recommended so that he can be more effective at work.
Has to schedule his day into hour-long segments.
I think the most egregious example of this, I read Going Infinite by Michael Lewis about Sam Bankman-Fried, who for a brief moment was worth $20 billion before he crashed and burned. And according to the book, this is a person who basically made every single life decision according to an expected value calculation. So plotting out the probability distribution of if I take this meeting, how much value would be generated, and then just canceling lots of meetings like in the moment of because he decided that they wouldn't generate value. That is the opposite of leisure, right? So a person worth $20 billion who has that mindset would be in the Aristotelian and Arendtian sense still in a slave consciousness.
I was going to add that because Zohar referenced the Greek scolia, you said, as a term. This is a Roman source, which is irrelevant to the discussion, but the etymology of the word is relevant because in Aeneas writes in Latin. So I checked leisure in this actual quote is the word otium. I think we talked about this like on one of the early podcasts because Francis was reading this book by this guy called Joseph Piper, which is about leisure. And it's interesting because the word for business in Latin is negotium. So all of the Latin languages, such as Spanish, Italian, French, blah, blah, blah. The word for business is negocio or negotio. No? And it's neg plus otium, which is the negation of otium. So it's like business, doing business is the negation of leisure. Yeah, in English we have the word business, but...
Negotiation, right?
Exactly, you have that, I get Zohar's point of doing something for the sake of itself. A lot has been written about, let's say, what is actual... I'm going to explain this without being super... So like a lot of art theory, to put it very simple, or a lot of aesthetics of what is the act of... and enjoying a work of art or creating a work of art. There's all of this talk of art being defined or the aesthetic experience being defined by the fact that it is purposeless. If the act of creation has a purpose, then it's not art. It's, let's say, don't take this the wrong way. It's design because there's a purpose, there's a utility imbued into the act of creating it. So to enrich the conversation, non-utility would be the point here. Like something that is not useful would be an act of leisure. And what's interesting is that, and this goes to Zohar's point about consumption, and this is a question I have, is when is consumption? Is consumption work? Aren't we working or working? Is consumption useful, utilitarian? I don't know if this rings a bell, but again, a lot has been written about this also, but yeah, when do we not do something that is useful for something else today, even if we don't want to? Because again, like watching Netflix 6 hours, that generates value for someone.
So is there no real leisure when you are in a capitalistic system? Is that what you're saying, Nico? That we don't have the opportunity for true leisure.
What if it's not Netflix? What if it's like The Lord of the Rings and you have that old DVD, no one's making a profit off that anymore and you just...
Yeah, but my point is that what I believe is that our quote-unquote free time has become commodified. Even if you're not doing something today, let's say if you're not working in the OG sense, putting in 8-9 hours of work a day or whatever, you're still like... Part, for instance, why do you pay someone a wage? Of course, you're like reciprocating their labor, but you're also paying them for, you're creating a consumer there. You're creating a demand there. Today, I feel that we live in a society of consumption more than in a society of production, where the important thing is to click, subscribe, all of this good stuff that we're interested in. That's what generates value today, no? So more than, let's say, someone, I don't know, chopping wood on the woods or moving boxes. There is an infrastructure, of course, no, but I do believe that leisure has become commodified to the point where what you do after work is perhaps more important than...
I think it's irrelevant whether it has been, in your words, commodified or not. The question is, what is leisure and is it possible? Whether we have to pay a $50 entry fee to go enjoy leisure is a secondary question to whether once paying that money, we can even experience leisure. I don't think the economics of leisure, this is just my personal view, make or breaks the more fundamental question, which is, do we even have the mindset for leisure? It's quite possible that a person could go to an event that's free or pay for it as a luxury product. And in both cases, even if the thing is marketed as leisure, it's surely not leisure. I'm not, and the other point is, I'm not sure that the substance of the activity is the thing that makes it leisure or not leisure. It could be the motivation that you're bringing to the activity. So even though I was being a little bit glib on the Netflix point, because that was, our rent is suspicious of mass culture, it is possible that 1 in 1,000 people watches Netflix, and for them, it genuinely is leisure. But the question is, so are we going to say that leisure is the same as escapism? I would think not. I would think, again, we're throwing a lot of categories on the table, but that there has to be some kind of nobility in the act that we should think about what acts are noble and what acts aren't. But like you can distinguish between healthy food and junk food, right? And then that would be on the object. Then on the subject, there's, you could have the most beautifully crafted farm to table meal, and if you're like not in a good space and your head is somewhere else, or you're just wolfing it down, that's also a squandering of this beautiful thing. And I suppose on the flip side, if you're Tom Hanks in the movie Castaway, and a Big Mac washes up onto the shore of the island where you're deserted, perhaps you enjoy it with such an immense sense of gratitude and awe that becomes leisurely. But I think in the usual circumstance, there's a fit between subject and object. Like, some things are more conducive to leisure because of their intrinsic features, their affordances, than others. And I think that if we think about the symposium in Plato as an example of leisure, one, it's social, and two, there's a search for something that's happening and you leave transformed, but you didn't go there with the expectation of I'm going to capture some deal flow here, or I'm going to meet a friend or a partner. Like, you went with a certain openness, and like the heart of the feast was like, let's talk about the meeting of love. I don't know, maybe I'm being too idealistic and like all those people were there for ulterior reasons, just same as they are today. But
Nico has something to say.
I think it's making me think of, then it would be the idea of going in with a goal versus going in with the openness to look. Like, to maybe paraphrase what you're saying, Zohar. And that makes me think of, there was this trend on Instagram where it was like, you should have 5 hobbies. One to make you money, one to advance your intellect, one to get you healthy. And I was like, my hobby is like beadwork. Like, it has no purpose whatsoever. I don't even make useful stuff half the time. And I think, but I like making it because I learn new ways to make things. I figure out some stuff. I daydream about things I could make. It's an entirely unproductive activity if you were to really reduce it down. And I think that, as we talk about, do we have the capacity for leisure today? It's like a lot of the messaging that exists says, no, we do not. You always have to be doing something for gain or for use.
Yeah.
I was going to bring this up because I think that I was giving what you could call a purely objective understanding of leisure, which is, I think, what's being sold today. Luxury today, to use another word, is sold as luxury. So for instance, I'll give you an example of what I mean.
Soap.
There was no concept of luxury in China because of the Soviet Union, the communist regime. So when China started opening up towards the West economically, they would put, let's say, a more sophisticated type of soap in a hotel versus a purely, let's say, okay, this is a bar of fat that you use to wash yourself. This has scent and it's beautiful, like it looks pretty, very pretty. But they had to tell the people, like, this is luxury soap. Like, it was written on the label. So there wasn't an understanding what leisure, let's say, what luxury is in that regard. And you can talk about this in a myriad of frequencies, but what I think, if we have lost the capacity to, let's say, to experience leisure in the way that we, let's say, purposeless activity or engagement has been understood in the West for like the past 500 years or whatever, what I would say is, at least from like my own readings and my own, I don't know, study, academic instruction or whatever, is that if that has happened, it's because we have lost the capacity to have an aesthetic experience. And this is something that was talked about by Immanuel Kant a lot, but basically the idea, and then it was refabricated again in the early 20th century, but the idea is the following, is that when cinema came around, it's as if, and the rise of what's called kitsch today, is as if the experience itself of the purposeless experience, no, becomes prefabricated and pre-digested for you. So there is nothing for you to do there except just shut up and like tune in. There is no, let's say, as Zohar was talking about before, let's say, noble function of our capacities, no? Of, let's say, organizing space and time, reinterpreting the world. It's done for you. It doesn't matter what you think about. This is it. This is it. Of course, you can, let's say, have your own opinion about things, but it's irrelevant. It's the work of art or the purposeless activity is already prefabricated for you. Again, to go to Anne's point about the five hobbies, this is, you see this all of the time. Okay, we understand what having a good life is, so you just need to imitate it. There is no creative function there. It's, you just need to like latch on to whatever is going on and what people think about the way that leisure is conceived, and that's good. And that's it.
Okay, so there was a philosopher, Jewish philosopher named Ibn Pakuda. We should run some quotes from him. But in any case, he wrote a book called Duties of the Heart. Super awesome book. And he makes a distinction between duties of the limbs and duties of the heart. So duties of the limbs would be like, you have an obligation to go ahead and build a sukkah or to put on these phylacteries on your arm or build a guardrail on your roof, whatever, like various laws you can find in the Bible that are there explicitly. Go give some money to a poor person. Any act that you do obviously requires physicality, so it's a duty of the limb. And then he invents this whole new category and says, actually, you have duties of the heart. It's not enough to just go ahead and do X, Y, and Z. You also need to feel it. You also need to understand that God loves you and that there's a unity to God and all these other things that aren't in the Bible. And he's just, listen, these things are foundational. So why am I mentioning that in response to Nico's point? Because in some sense, these duties of the limbs are prefabricated, right? There's a certain, like in Judaism, there's 613 laws. Go ahead and do them. There's variation in interpretation, but those are the things you're supposed to do. I see no contradiction between prefabricated luxury or prefabricated leisure and genuine leisure. I think that, in fact, if I were to be practical, as much as we can make fun of Instagram for that, maybe there's some wisdom there. Take on a prefabricated set of things, do them inauthentically, and practice makes perfect. Then come to bring your duty of the heart to them. Come, start with your duties of the limb. Start with just, okay, bicycling brings me joy, or whatever, yoga brings me joy. And then come and deepen your relationship to leisure through that. I'm not sure that you need to start with this more pure understanding of leisure and start getting all neurotic about, oh no, capitalism makes it impossible for me to enjoy myself. Ah, just get out of your own head, go for a run, whatever, go be basic. And eventually you won't be basic, and that's fine. So I think that this, the duties of the heart versus duties of the limbs and this sort of authenticity versus inauthenticity, there's a tendency to make these things opposite to one another. But I also like the idea that the duties of the heart are foundational, but they're also supplemental and they'll emerge just from having a practice that you commit to.
So
there's an idea in Judaism, one more point on this, which is mitoch shelo lishma balishma. If you do something for the ulterior reason, eventually you'll come to do it for its own sake. So maybe I start learning Torah because I want to impress my teacher, or I want to win the hand in marriage of somebody or whatever. And so my motivations are wrong. I'm sure many of us here at some point in our childhood development, I'll speak for myself, wanted to show off how smart we were. And that's why we like did the extra reading. It wasn't because we were like delighting in the wisdom of the book. It was for some superficial reason. But look at us now. Like, I'm sure that we don't have such a superficial relationship to knowledge acquisition that it's purely for this narcissistic display. I'm sure that there is a part of us, speak for myself, that I actually find this to be deeply meaningful, and that's what sustains me in it. That's lightning.
Yeah. So, I have a question before I forget. You brought up binging Netflix and whatnot, and then Nico went further into talking about movies, how it's all the thinking is done for you, and therefore you're removing the nobler idea of figuring out the world, which I also want to go back to and ask, what defines a noble activity in the Greek or Latin sense, whichever one we're choosing to go by. I know where the author's Latin is Roman, but you brought up the Greeks. But what did the Greeks or the Romans think about plays then? Like, is that not leisure? Did they not count that as leisure? I suppose that's tied into the question. Is that not a leisurely activity? Or is that a societal duty to show up to the theater and see the morality lesson at play or whatever?
I can say one thing or two. I don't, because I can speak hours about this, but it depends who you ask, basically. It depends which Greek you ask. But you touched on a very important point, is that, let's say, if you're going to try and understand what the Greeks, like if you're going to watch a movie today as the Greeks watched, let's say, a tragedy, I have a question. Does the movie have some sort of function that we do not, that we pass by? Because a tragedy for the Greeks was not a pure performance. It was a religious social event. And I'm contradicting myself now, but to which extent, because we have, what I was trying to point to is that
it's not leisure. It's not leisure. It's entertainment. It's politics. It's many things, but it's a pretext for leisure. So to give you a contemporary example, when I go to the Broadway play, that's not leisure. But when I go out for coffee afterwards to talk about it with my friends, that's leisure. Because this, I think, connects to Nico's point about consumption. Like, in the Broadway play, even though I'm like suspended, so that's good, that I'm not like in work mode necessarily, but I'm still there to cultivate myself. And it's good to have these talking points to be able to go out and say, yeah, I saw that play. Yeah, I have an opinion on it. Like that's work. But when you're in the state of meaning making and it's the activity, you switch from just being the pure passive receptacle for what's happening, and you become a co-producer. That's where I think you're engaging in leisure. So it's a paradox that leisure actually requires some proactivity. And maybe that's my critique on the Netflix. If you went and you talked to your friend about the TV show, so then the Netflix becomes good fodder for leisure. But I think if you're just sitting there binging all alone, then I'm not sure that's leisure. That seems like it's exactly what Ennius is talking about, where it's not work and it's not work. So you'd be better off just like working hard or totally not working.
Genevieve, you have something to say.
So guys, I watched La Gramboletta 3 times in a row. The first time was just because I was like, oh gosh, damn, that's so good. And then I caught myself, I was like, okay, I need to go back because this was so good. And I started to watch, and then I started in media res, right? I was in the middle, and then I was like, wait, I gotta go backwards. Wait, and then I went forward. And then at the end, I realized like I actually watched it 3 times in a row, and I had just been sitting there. And then I went on to a Fellini. I was like, okay, I know that there are references to 8.5. I gotta go to Fellini. I need to see what happened. And what I ended up doing was, you could say I binged for an entire weekend on Italian film, but I didn't go in it with the thing of meaning making. I just genuinely have a curiosity for good storytelling, sometimes design, sometimes just pure beauty. Like, it's actually visually tantalizing to just sit and watch La Gramboletta. And even the language is just so good. And so for me, it's like, it comes back to this idea of, why are we questioning why are we asking ourselves the question of what's the difference between leisure and work? Because I think when we even think about semantics or we think about etymology, words have changed over time, right? What was once, I'll use an example of the word of awful. Awful actually meant in awe-inspiring at one point. That's how it was used, right? And now it's, oh God, that's so awful. There's such negative connotation. Nervous used to mean really strong, right? It meant, wow, like courageous. But now it doesn't mean that. It means actually like it more has the sense of like anxiety driven. So I guess the question is, what is the value? What is the ultimate value that we would be achieving in asking what's the difference between leisure and work? Because for me, I don't look at work as like always objective seeking. For me, actually, work to me is as I am either making dinner or not. To me, it's, or if I'm having even rituals, to me, down to some of my practices, personal practices, it is in essence something of work, but it's also of leisure. And does it really matter? As I'm contemplating that. So I'd really want to know why do we care to separate the two or distinguish the two right now?
I think the Industrial Revolution changed the concept of work, right? It made it very explicit, where most people at that time were then, you had hours that you worked and your work was taxing and physical and these types of things. And it's funny because it made me think that Roland Barthes, who is the semiotic king, wrote a book called Mythologies. And in it, he talks about how for the artist, there is no real leisure because everything relates back to your art. And as you move through society, you're always moving through the lens of like examination or even curiosity or usefulness or things like this, like almost a constant state of critique or inspiration. And so his argument was that there was no real leisure, but his counterpoint was a class of people that had very industrial jobs and could take a time away at the beach where if they're not physically present, then they're not working. So I think there is a distinction between this kind of Industrial Revolution, I think what we would probably call like blue collar worker who does have a very physically engaging job that can be left and returned to, versus maybe to Zohar's beginning point, like this white collar, more aristocratic view of working and leisure where they're intermingled and harder to differentiate.
I'll tell you why I think it matters, Genevieve. It's a great question. In Genesis, God creates the world in 6 days of work. And then on the seventh day, God rests, calls the seventh day a Sabbath. The Torah doesn't say the seventh day is a day separate from creation. It actually says that the seventh day is part of creation and completes creation. So right there you have in one of the most foundational stories about the creation of the world, the dialectic between 6 days of effort, 6 days of changing things, 6 days of looking at things and saying they're not good as they stand and they need to be improved, and one day of saying everything is perfect, everything is enough. And if you just had the 6 days of creation and you didn't have the seventh day of rest, it would be a very different story. Encoded in the theological and metaphysical view of the world is the idea that God is leisurely. But there's a ratio. It's not like God is all leisure and just chills and the world just happens because God sits there doing nothing. But nor is it the view of God as a sort of hustle guru who's, I'll tell you how to get the best workflow. And creation is conceived of as this perfect work process. It's the combination of the two. I think that sets up humanity to feel this tension between defining ourselves through our work and also realizing that our work can't exhaust who we are. And maybe what makes humans have dignity is the fact that we are able to rest, just like God rests. Now, if you fast forward to Exodus, which is a story of a people that was enslaved and then was liberated from slavery, when they were slaves, they didn't have control over their own time. And I think it's important to think about slavery less in terms of being owned by another person and more this idea of who does your time belong to? Do you think of yourself as on the clock? I think if we take that more expansive view, it's possible that a person could be self-employed or have a very fancy job, but their orientation is still within the lens of they're always on the clock. They're always on someone else's clock. And I think that puts them in that slave consciousness. One of the first things that the Israelites are commanded to do when they're liberated from Egypt is to keep the Sabbath, which connects the Exodus to the Genesis, as if to say, the purpose of being free is so that you can rest. And you can obviously think about how revolutionary this was in terms of labor law. Fast forward many hundreds of years, and we now have the weekend. Like, where did the weekend come from? It comes from the Bible. But I think then going back to the leisure question, what's at stake is, okay, it's very nice that we get to not work on Saturday and Sunday in America, and that's actually because of pluralism regarding religion. And in other societies, they work 6 days a week. The weekend's only one day. What are you going to do with your weekend time? How are you going to relate to the weekend? Is the weekend sacred to you, or is it a time to catch up on work? That's what's at stake. How do you relate to the weekend? And thinking about that as a metaphor, right? Because I think we get a micro dose of that at 6 p.m., 7 p.m. on a weekday, if you will, 8 p.m., 9 p.m., whatever it is. But are you always on? And when you're not always on, so what is the relationship with the time? In the religious tradition, the Greco-Romans would call this leisure noble, aristocratic. I think the religious tradition would call it holy. They would call it divine. When is your activity mundane and when is it divine?
When is it? In your opinion?
Posing it to the group.
Oh.
I don't know. I struggle with not seeing everything as mundane. That's the whole problem.
Artist.
I guess that's my problem. I don't know, but I think that's everybody's problem.
I'm sorry. Sometimes I just want to see the inside of Nico's mind, where everything is catechism and mundane.
I was going to say one or two things though.
Nico's been going through the Nico.
What Zohar said. Because I can have a fairly clear and like demarcation of what can be considered. What can be, like, let's say, is it difficult to define leisure and work? Okay, yes, it's difficult because we're having all of this discussion. But we produce, right? We accumulate stuff. That's why we work, no? And we accumulate and we produce, and that goes on. This is what I wanted to ask Zohar about the Genesis stuff, is where is destruction in the whole drama of creation? Because at least I subscribe. Yeah, because I subscribe to the idea that
it's in Genesis. It's in Genesis 6. Okay. the story of the flood. The story of the flood is creation 2.0, which is God destroys the entire world minus Noah and his family and two of each animal and saves them from destruction. So you actually have two creation stories. You have one that's God as, to use Cyrus's example, creative brainstormer. And then you have God as very severe editor in Genesis chapter 6, which is actually, this is all garbage. Let's go back to the drawing board.
Yeah.
Next space.
Yeah, I was thinking about two things. One is that this is Aeneas, so we're talking about the Roman context. Some of these guys used to have festivals and carnivals and Saturnalias and all of these things. And those things would be considered leisure, I presume. But it was a destructive leisure, a form of conspicuous consumption where all of the roles would be inverted. Some of these would last for months. So it's not, we cannot like really assimilate to what the Romans experienced as leisure.
Yeah, but if you spend an hour of time, if you spend an hour of time doing something that doesn't add obvious value, that is a kind of conspicuous destruction. Let's say in the ancient world, you would go and you would pour out wine at the altar of the gods. And that would be an obvious example of don't you want to drink the wine? What are you doing? But we're all pouring out the wine, so to say, whenever we take an hour to just do nothing or to do something without an expectation of how it's going to go, just to see, maybe this could change my life. I don't know. Maybe it couldn't. Maybe it could. I have no problem saying there are activities I do that every week that are deeply meaningful. And just as you could say that God accepts the sacrifice, I think you could say that the leisure is efficacious, but maybe this is the crux of it. This is the paradox, right? If you go into the sacrifice thinking, I'm just doing a little magic. I'm just doing a little maneuver, a little manipulation. And I know that God's going to accept it if I do X, Y, and Z and do it in this way. That's not a real sacrifice. That's like sorcery or something. That's some kind of power play. You have to go in with this genuine openness of like, maybe the sacrifice will work. Maybe it won't. And almost do the rejection therapy of 9 times out of 10 or 99 times out of 100, it doesn't work. And you're still showing up because you believe in the value of showing up. And then something beautiful happens, which is it's accepted and it's transformational.
So risk
sounds like
is the answer. So yeah, I that's where I was thinking. It's like,
yeah,
it's like an apology. It's like, you know?
Anything that involves risk that you have to, you're willing to lose something, or you have to,
if you, you have engage, to surrender, yeah. And you have to surrender, and you can't seek to control the outcome. I think this is one of the core points in work and labor, is that we go in with certain expectations and we try to minimize the chance that something is going to go haywire. And if there is a fundamental uncertainty, we price that into our expectations and we do our best to model it out. Whereas I think when we're showing up with no expectation or with suspended expectation, it's not because we don't want some outcome, but we're trying not to let that get in the way, lest our effort screw it up. I guess a good example would be the paradox even in dating. If you show up and you say the quiet part out loud, I'd like to have a family, I'd like to fall in love. Do you think you'd be interested in the same thing? Maybe that would work with some people, but you, there is like a certain subtlety, right? Where it's, that could scare a person off if you come on so strong. So you play this game of whatever, we're just talking, no big deal. No big deal, second date, no big deal, third date. Okay, at some point you have to like take the risk of, okay, hey, are we serious? But the point is now that are we serious thing was implied in the beginning, but nobody wants to say it out loud because it's gonna, unless you're into like, let's say 3 dates and let's get married, but you know, that's or maybe too utilitarian. But in the romantic view, we treat dating as leisure, even though it's also kind of work. It's both, right? Because you want to enjoy the romance of getting to know someone, and maybe you have a certain hope that it's gonna lead somewhere serious and committed, I think. So this would be a good example of like with sacrifice, where weirdly enough, and this is not dating advice, but maybe it is, by not putting all your cards on the table, even to yourself, and having a certain self-delusion that, oh, I'm just in it for its own sake, that weirdly enough, that will actually get you the better outcome than coming in with this more explicit perspective. Again, there are probably people who, if they could match explicit to explicit, could just cut the games. But I think for a lot of us, we're off put by that. And the same would be true by analogy. Let's say the God doesn't want you to come on too strong and say, hey, I brought you the wine, so you can accept it. That's not how it works. You get to know me a little bit, ask me about my life, and then I'll decide if I want to accept your sacrifice.
That's also like when you brought up sacrifices, like that's how apology works, right? If you just, you're expecting them to forgive you, like, hey, I'm sorry. No, I'm not going to accept that apology. You go in nice. And you say, my bad, do you forgive me? Like a sincere question. And then the person could say no.
Exactly. The apology is for its own sake. It's not for the sake of eliciting the acceptance of the apology. And that's exactly, we know the difference between a genuine and an ingenuine apology exactly on this axis, which is, do you have contrition for its own sake, or is the contrition an effort to placate the person hearing it? Go ahead.
When does sacrifice become instrumental then? Because for instance, I'll use a Catholic point of view here. So I'll do whatever I want. I'll do all of these things and then I can just go and do my confession and maybe get a Eucharist in the way and I'm good. This is like the Woody Allen thing, is if you have to pick a religion, which one would it be? It would be Catholic, because why would I just have to repent and that's fine and I'm good. So I'm personally interested in this question because it's related to whatever my academic work, but the idea of like, why do people repeatedly do something, well, that they don't know if it works or not? And this is like the whole point about sacrifice, is that it is a sacrifice because you don't know what the real outcome of it will be. No, it is a risk, it is a gamble, no? But it seems to degenerate into this thing. You don't know, but you can do it all the time. So it becomes a form of insurance. Religion can work that way. And I love when it works this way because you see it, how it becomes secularized. Okay, like maybe I have a question, which is, do people with life insurance, I want to see if they're religious.
I think the fact that these beautiful ideals can be gamed and manipulated doesn't invalidate them. It just means that many humans are so deviant that they'd rather win at their puny little games than actually appreciate the genuine grace that is before them. I'm not a Christian, but I'll play the role of the priest here for a second and say, Jesus is so full of love for you that even though you're like totally sort of misusing the confessional, like he loves you anyways. Like the joke's on you that you think you even have to cheat your way, that you even have to cheat your way to grace. It reminds me of the story of there's a Hasidic rabbi who was robbed by a thief. And as the thief is running away with his wallet, he shouts at the guy, "I want you to have it." Because he doesn't want the guy to be, he loves humanity so much that he doesn't want this person to have on his theft. He wants to exempt him from that sin. And again, it goes back to this mitosh shelo lishma balishma. You start out with the wrong reason and eventually you come to the right one. And I think if we will bring in the Eastern tradition here, just because we keep it diverse right. And pluralistic.
Nirvana.
You can go through it. You can take your example of the guy who's, "I'm going to sin and then I'm going to go to confessional. I'm going to say my Hail Marys and then I'm going to go back out and be a debauched, depraved person and rinse and repeat." If you take an Eastern perspective on this, this person can do it in 1,000 lifetimes. He can literally go through thousands of reincarnations and make the same mistake over and over and over again. But I think the point is that at some point you get it. Like at some point after just hitting your head against the wall, you realize, you know what, this is pretty boring actually. There's no delta, there's no transformation. What if I actually gave this a chance? So I can't say on what timeline people are going to achieve the truth, but I guess I do take an optimism that at some point, maybe it takes 10,000 years, they get there. At some point we achieve leisure, maybe not in this lifetime.
Since you brought up Eastern religion, Nico, what's the Indian or Hindu or Vedic view on leisure?
You got me there. I don't know.
Time to look it up.
I haven't explored this aspect within those traditions, but what I could say is that we're talking about sacrifice, right? And the festivity, the ritual itself is leisurely, or at least it used to be leisurely. But I'll give you one thing, which is that, because I've studied this a lot, and the idea is that in the ancient days, like in the Vedic times, when you would do a sacrifice or you would engage in ritual, it would be extremely risky, agonical. So it wasn't something you would just do because you wanted to get something. It involved, let's say, a warrior's ethic, because you might lose a lot of things in the act of the sacrifice. And I think there's something to that in regards to what we're talking about, going back to this thing about risk, that perhaps the biggest form of leisure we can find is the one that involves the biggest amount of risk. No, so like maybe this is an apology for gambling. I find that fascinating. It sounds crazy, but that happens. I'm not a gambler myself. I never gambled a dime in my life. But you see that someone the other day that was telling me about, I don't know which, whatever, neurotransmitter, dopamine, serotonin, whatever. Like they measured in gamblers, and it's insane. Like what happens when they lose and what happens when they win. No? Huh. I would call that leisure. Like they're getting high on something without using any substances.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. So disagree, Nico.
Yeah. This has to be continued. This has to be continued.
Is not positively correlated with leisure in my view. I think it's like the leisure is healthy food and gambling is junk food. I think maybe you need to learn from the gambler some spiritual lesson and apply it in another context. But I think there's probably nothing sadder than a person like who lives in a casino, so to say.
This is a discussion about what is noble and is leisure supposed to be noble. But unfortunately, we are running out of time. This is what's great about our WhatsApp Chronicles group chat, because there is no running out of time. It's constant. It keeps going. We have a discussion going right now that's been going for 2 days. It's perfect. It's amazing. Guys, thank you so much for joining, giving us your time. See you next week.